Hello and welcome to another episode of Is This Just Fantasy, the podcast where every week two nerds get together to rate, read and review a fantasy novel. I'm your host, Geordie Bailey.
And I'm the man who was punished by the gods to do this podcast to the end of time, Duncan Nicol.
Duncan, it's good to be back. It might not have been so long for our listeners, but it feels like quite a long time.
I know, we've had a real good break. We've both been away on holiday. Oh, but we're back in the room. Mm-hmm. Geordie, how was your time away? You went hiking.
I did. I had a very nice time. I went off hiking in Sweden. I started off by a visit to Stockholm, where I saw a Bruce Springsteen concert, which was... I had fun. I always have fun at Bruce Springsteen's concerts. I think that was my fourth time going to see him. But I will tell you this, Duncan. I learned something about Swedes. Swedes do not get up and dance at concerts.
Sorry.
They don't. I was quite flummoxed by this because there were people who all around me just sat down throughout the whole performance. They had their arms crossed. They stared straight ahead. And occasionally, someone would stand up and like wave their hands in the air and other people would sort of do it in a ripple. And then they would sit straight back down and cross their arms again. It was a bit unnerving.
Wait, so expensive concerts. At the front, there's normally, like, standing. Like, there was still that.
Oh, yeah. They're going crazy.
The people at the back in the seats are like, no. It's a clear divide. You make your decision when you buy your ticket.
That's right. I paid for this seat. I'm going to sit in it.
Jordy, I, to this day, can't get over the fact that when you go and see a band, the standing tickets are more expensive. This makes no sense to me. Like, I'm getting less. Like, if you go to the Globe, they're the cheapest seats. A precedent was set by Shakespeare.
I was just about to say at the Globe, you want to be a groundling.
No, when I go to the Globe, mate, I always get the seat. I've actually never stood. I'm like, no. I'm at the top. In the shade.
I don't know, man. I've never been a groundling either, but I have had bad experiences of seating in the Globe. I had to spend all of Richard III, leaning ever so slightly to the side to look past a wooden column, a column which my mum was sat directly behind like she was Jenny Nicholson on the Star Cruiser. Trying to wait to see if Duncan gets that joke.
No.
Okay, we'll come back to that. But yes, I went to Sweden, and after I went to this concert, I went off on my hike. I was hiking for a week up the Hugokusterleden, the high coast way, and it was great. It was supposed to be a 7-day trek. I actually ended up doing it in 6.
Brack.
It's a very beautiful coastal trek, quite far north. In Sweden, I never ever saw the sunset. I normally went to bed pretty early because I got tired. So I settled down in my tent and then it would be fully light. And then you'd wake up in the morning at 5 o'clock and it was fully daytime. I only saw the sun rise once on my last night where I was just too uncomfortable. I kept waking up. I said, fine, whatever, I'll get started early. So I got up at 3 a.m. and I started my hike. So I managed to see the So then, at 3 a.m., I managed to see the sun come up. But on that last day, I normally did about 25 kilometers a day. But on the last day, I kind of reached my end point, where I wanted to be for day 6, by 12 o'clock. And a lot of things sort of happened around that time. One, I was feeling really good and full of energy, and like, yeah, I could keep going. The other thing that happened was, I was just straight up out of water. Like, period. It was a hot day. It was very dry. And I couldn't just camp there because the only water to drink was the Baltic Sea. And I'm told that's a bad idea.
Good survival instinct, mate.
Thank you. That's me. I'm a wilderness man now. I know these things. So I just said, I'm going to keep walking. I'm just going to keep walking, at least until I find a water source. It'll just make tomorrow, my last day, way easier. It's already going to be a short day. And then, about, like, 30 kilometers into my trek, I'm stopping. I find a stream to fill up my bottle.
Oh, and see, my parents. I thought that. When you said a water source, in my head, like, in the English countryside, that's like, oh, yeah, you found a pub. And you go in, you're like, can you fill up my bottle for me at the bar? No, yeah, you found a little stream up in the mountains.
And then I called my parents and I told them, yeah, I'm feeling pretty good today. I think I might even try and press towards the end. And my dad said, oh, good idea if you're feeling up to it. In fact, we'll look into what hotel rooms might be available for you at the end. And I thought, that's a great idea. Now I have something to look forward to. I keep walking. 15 minutes later, I get a text from my mum. And she says, okay, we've booked you a hotel room. Well, that's not what we agreed. You said you'd look into them and see if there are any available. And now there is one that's not just available, but it's paid for and it's waiting for me, which means I have to make it.
Oh, so the pressure's on.
Every other day, I walked between 20 and 25 kilometers. On that last day, I walked 47 kilometers and had to climb over 3 bergs to get to the end.
What time did you get into that hotel room?
To be honest, not that late, but again, I started at 3 a.m., so I got in at, like, 5:30. So, 3 a.m. to 5, it's like 14 hours of hiking, with some breaks.
That is full-on Fellowship of the Ring-style stuff, mate. Jesus.
I did have so much more sympathy for Sam and his poor little hobbit feet. He didn't even have shoes on! He was climbing through Mordor. That's not fair. But also, I don't feel bad because they stopped at Rivendell for like 3 months. Like, come on.
Wait, no. They do. Can you imagine if they hadn't? Like, all the other events, like the Battle of Pelennor Fields. Like, all those people who die at Minas Tirith could have not? They just
don't think about
on.
It. Don't think about it.
Not that they didn't deserve a little break. Yes, so that's an incredible...
But also, if they didn't, they wouldn't have Legolas and Gimli and Boromir.
I guess.
Anyway, I had a great time in Sweden. The Swedes were very friendly. On my second day on the trek, it was raining all day long, and it was heavy rain. So as I was limping towards my final destination, climbing up a hill, looking very miserable, a very nice Swedish man called Jörvan came out of his house and insisted I stay in his guest house.
Now, you see, what's so lovely about this story, I hope, and obviously I know it ends well because you're back with us. If that happened to me in the UK, one, it wouldn't. And two, my instant reaction would be, no, I'm good. And then get the hell further up that path. What do you mean you're being nice to me? You know, you can't show me charity. That doesn't add up.
Much like in ancient Greece, I relied on the hospitality of my host to never betray me or turn me into a pig. But Duncan, before we get into that, how have your holidays been? What have you been up to?
This and that. I'm a man who's doing a lot of DIY, a lot of beautiful gardening. I laid turf the first time, Geordie. Have you ever laid turf before?
Very nice. Have I laid turf before?
Yes.
Only as a euphemism.
Well, apparently the best way to do it is with a bread knife. And then you have to be very unfriendly to the environment and water it twice a day. In fact, when I did go away on my holiday, I went to a festival. I had to ask my mum, could you come round my house and water my lawn for me? Which made me feel very weird.
But it's settled now, is it? It's taken root?
It's definitely done very well. A few little dry patches. Don't worry, I did leave notes, have words for my mother. It's like, excuse me? I have to do all of it. Doesn't count otherwise. But no, that's turned out brilliant. Well, I'm actually going to talk to you, Geordie, before we get into this actual book of this episode's named after. Geordie, after our Thrawn trilogy, people who listen to that might be like, guys, get off Star Wars, we're done. But I fell back into the wormhole, so I just need to like dive on it one more time. Geordie, like my favourite YouTuber, Sarcastic Productions, did an episode talking about Revenge of the Sith. I haven't seen that one yet. In a weird way. We read the novel. I never asked you this, Geordie. Like, are you happy that I got you to read Revenge of the Sith first? Or do you think I should have just gone straight in with Heir of the Empire as Star Wars novels go?
I think they're both decent choices for starting points. But I have no regrets about you picking that one. Although I think they're not as good. It's a Thrawn trilogy. Question is, I don't know whether, considering it was such early days in the podcast, I probably wouldn't have chosen to read the second one. I feel like I would have been like, I don't want to get bogged down so early in our podcast history. We need to do, what did you do after that? I think it was Good Omens. Yeah, so I'm glad you didn't introduce me to it back then, because we probably wouldn't have given it so much of our airtime.
Well, not to give it too much more, but Geordie, so I listened to this YouTube video from Sarcastic Productions, and they brought up fan edits again. I just want to talk about this. I fell into like the wormhole of like Star Wars fan edits, and Jordy, there's one of them that I just want to tell you about because it's so cool. It's talked about in that episode by Sarcastic Productions, and what it is, it's a fan edit.
Just to jump in, it's Overly Sarcastic Productions, just in case you people haven't heard of them. Much more successful content creators than us, and you want to check them out. They do make very good videos on history and media tropes.
Again, if you're listening to us, you've probably heard of them. They do, in this episode, they talk about a Star Wars fan edit called Black Mantle, and it is amazing. Geordie, imagine this. Revenge of the Sith in black and white.
Okay.
Okay, bit basic, but let me add to that. Revenge of the Sith in black and white, but edited together with scenes from Phantom Menace and Attack of the Clones put in as flashbacks. So it's like the whole prequel trilogy functions as one like 2.5 hour feature.
All right, sure. The one Star Wars fan edit I've ever seen was there. It was an edit to Attack of the Clones, and literally all they did was they took the final scene of Qui-Gon being killed by Darth Maul and the Darth Maul being killed by Obi-Wan, and they just stapled it to the front of Attack of the Clones. And the point being, that's literally all you need from the first movie. Like, that's all that matters, is Obi-Wan, the Sith have returned, and Qui-Gon gives the injunction to Obi-Wan, train the boy.
And while those things are great, if you're watching that fan edit, guess what? You've already suffered through The Phantom Menace. That's how it happens. Unless you have a really good friend who's, like, going to bring you in, but in a really weird way. But anyway, so back to Black Mantle. So it does that. Okay, but here's the real kicker. They use the Japanese dub and then rewrite the subtitles. So many dialogue fixes.
That's
and I'm going to call them
genius.
Fixes.
Oh my God.
I've done it. So when you watch it, it's actually like watching it new. So I've watched other fan edits of like the prequel trilogy, and often they're just cut down versions. They've taken off some of the less... engaging scenes. They've redone the music here and there to give it a different vibe, but they just said it. You're watching the same movie again. You have moments where you go, oh, that was different to how I remembered it, but ultimately the same thing. This makes it a completely different viewing experience. They rephrase
this. It legitimately sounds really interesting.
They rephrase it so that Padme and Anakin, that's not a secret, you know. Obi-Wan's literally like, go and see your wife. Have a lovely time. They do it so that what Anakin's looking for, it's what gets his attention, is that he can see the future. It's his premonitions that make the Jedi take an interest in him. And what he's going to Palpatine for is, Palpatine's like, have you heard of Plagueis the Wise? He too could see the future, but he learned how to change his visions. They're not set in stone. Lots of changes like that and more. And it was what made it so great, is I actually felt like I was watching something new. Also, obviously, if you do speak Japanese, it's going to completely throw you off, because they've just used the normal dub and then rewritten the subtitles. So you'll be there like, that's not what they said. They just said the normal line. But other than that, really great way of like reworking and feeling new, genuinely feeling fresh again. So highly recommend it. It was great.
Also, like, because Japan has such like a robust animation industry that requires a lot of voice acting, they have a huge suite of incredibly talented voice actors. So even if you've occasionally seen stuff like the Japanese dub of Thor Ragnarok or The Boys, you know, oh my God, these guys do incredible like dub work. It sounds so vivid and and dramatic, and you know, like, it's an anime.
The dude who does Hayden Christensen, like, I don't know his name, but he does amazing. Like, the intensity, he is not phoning it in, he is giving it 110%. Like, fantastic. But enough about Star Wars. I had to just do it one more time. Geordie, we're here to talk about a really amazing book.
Yes.
I'm also going to use the word prestigious, not only because it's won so many awards, actual like literature awards, but it's the sequel to the book that in many ways won our award for the like the best, most highest ranked book on this podcast in a bit of a complex fashion. Go listen to our top 50 to hear about it. But the sequel to Song of Achilles by Madeline Miller, we're talking today about Circe.
Sequel, prequel, midquel, a roundabout all.
More like the continuing saga, isn't it? Chronicles.
Now, this book is very strange. I guess we're just starting our review now, because... Is there something else you want to say, Duncan, or can I start?
Geordie, are you about to give your thoughts on it? I think I should just add a little forewarning. I have actually read this book before. I did mention that previously. So I've actually read this book before Song of Achilles. This is my reread for me, but it's the first time rereading it since reading Song of Achilles. So I'll hand it over to you, Geordie. Give your first thoughts, and then I'll fill people in on what this book is about.
Yes. So this book is the, as I said, like... It surrounds Song of Achilles. Song of Achilles is a very minute, narrow story, even though it takes place over the span of 10 years, which is a long time, even in the canon of all of literature. Like, 10 years is, like, pretty standard for, like, some of the Dickens novels. But also some of his novels take place over, you know, an afternoon. This one takes place over a substantially longer period of time. Potentially all of human history, pretty much. Like, from Mycenaean Greece to, like, the end. The entire heroic age of Greece. Not what I expected at all. Because I knew that it was about Circe, and I knew it was going to be about her relationship with Odysseus, and that is an important part of this book, which is why I picked it for our Troy Book of the Year, because apparently we do one every year. We're going to do David Gemmell's one at some point. But that is, turns out, quite a small part of a great story of Circe, because really, this book is not strictly about Circe. It is the orbital platform which Madeline Miller flies around so she can do all of the greatest hits of Greek mythology and its canon.
Yes, that is one way to put it. I do feel like it's still quite a narrative. Like, this is Circe's story. But Circe's story, and I'm going to be clear, Geordie, I'm not super familiar with the closest thing to the Greek canon, Homer's works. I don't really know where a lot of this stacks up compared to that sort of established lore.
It's a mix and match. Even though I'm a huge fan of Greek mythology, and it's been an obsession of mine since I was a boy, I really didn't know much about Circe. I knew that she showed up, she lived beyond just the Odyssey. Like, I knew she was related to Medea somehow, but that's all I knew. And to be honest, I'm not sure how much of this book is sort of made up. Like, I believe I read in the start of this book, it comes with I listened to the audiobook of Kirke. And
what's that pronunciation?
And Kirke.
Circe.
Kirke. It's pronounced Kirke. It's an ancient Greek name. We didn't have a s sound, or Caesar pronounced with a k. The audiobook narrator didn't agree with me, but audiobook narrators are wrong about pronunciation all the time. If you've ever listened to the audiobook for The Crystal Shard, and indeed the first three books in the trilogy of Drizzt, or whatever it's called, that dude could not pronounce the word he couldn't pronounce the word lived.
Livid.
No, lived. Like, he lived. He pronounced it lived.
Ooh.
I know! That's not an obscure word!
Oh, Geordie, that, like, if you were to do it wrong, you would say livid, because at least that's another word.
I know. He was always pronouncing it like it was the word live, like it's live on television.
And he lived. Wow.
Yes. And once the good people of Brimshanda lived within within Icewind Dale, God almighty. Anyway, I'm right, she's wrong, it's Kirke.
I will be pronouncing it Circe for the rest of this episode, just to show solidarity with everyone else who's wrong out there, apparently.
But yes, I didn't know much about Kirke or her connection to other parts of the great mythos. I'm sure most of it is made up. I know from the appendix at the start that it says the story of Glaucus is taken from Ovid's Metamorphosis. And I somewhat doubt that Circe is actually a part of that story. I think she's sort of just stapled. I said Circe, damn it. I somehow doubt that Kirke was actually a part of that story. I feel like she was made into an important witness.
And I think that's very fair. I think the majority of people who read this bit will be coming from my standpoint of knowing nothing. So, and I do think it's perfectly fair to twist this and write on it and expand on it, give your own take. This is someone's own take. So when it does divulge, that means nothing to me. Like, it's not a knock.
And in the same way that Song of Achilles and Science of the Girls, they stray from the canon. You know, she sticks to it in ways where you can tell she's making a point to say, I am paying attention to canon, I am referencing it here, and I'm being very deliberate about this. Like, a dude falls off the roof in this book, and it feels a bit out there, but I check the front of the book, and it says, this dude fell off the roof in the Odyssey. And I'm like, okay, I forgot about that bit.
So I think that skill gives the explanation. Allow me just to, that kind of open summary. Circe is the witch from the Odyssey. She lives on an island that Odysseus lands upon. There is magic. There are people being turned into pigs. And ultimately, Odysseus is his normal, charming, smart self. And he resolves the issue. No spoilers just yet. But this book, you're right, it focuses purely on Circe. And it goes right back to her beginnings as a child of the Titan Helios and Perseus.
Duncan, for this book, I'm never ever gonna make fun of you for struggling to pronounce these, because it is full of characters who are from Greek mythology but are not main players whatsoever. And I'm looking at the pronunciation guide and it is doing me no help. The number of names which are extremely similar to each other. We've got Protens and Perses and Perse and Pasiphaea. They're all members of the same family, by the way. Perse, Perses, and Pasiphaea.
Oh, this is going to hurt. Jordy, I had something very recently. I was listening to the Your Dead to Me podcast put out by the BBC. It's a great history podcast. I learned something. I learned a pronunciation thing, and it actually blew my mind. Because not only was I wrong, but all of my teachers at schools apparently were wrong. So can I just ask you, what's the name of the theorem about the length of the hypotenuse of a right-angled triangle?
Pythagoras theorem?
Pythagoras. Blew my mind.
Very good.
I told this to my Greek colleague. He went, obviously, you stupid Englishman. Right.
Yeah. Just like Van Gogh or Genghis Khan. We forget all about the actual pronunciation of these historical names.
But she is the daughter of these two beings. She is not the most loved daughter, and she has a very hard childhood in this time.
Right from the start, we get our most coherent theme throughout the book, which is everyone is mean to Kirke all the time.
It's actually difficult, for me a little bit at points, to read through this. Like, I found this very challenging because I felt the meanness in this, almost, I don't know if it, unlike, I'm trying to get a Song of Achilles, that's probably unfair, but so much of it seems completely like out of almost nowhere. It's like, why are you being horrible to her? She's done nothing extra. She is no extra. She is just as she is, and everyone, even if it's not like outwardly horrific, it's almost like the thing they're being most mean to this person about is that she's not as mean as they are.
Yeah, it's a book full of Regina Georges. I'm going to actually say, Duncan, that this theme throughout the book of everyone is just mean to Kirke all the time and they all suck, it just really didn't actually resonate with me as much as I felt it was supposed to. So this is obviously a deeply sad book, like down to its very bones. There's very little joy to be had, and that sort of overbearing continuous sense of misery is sort of just like rolled over me like pebbles. I described this to my girlfriend the other day when I was leading up to recording this episode, I said, the thing about Song of Achilles is that sad, bad stuff happens throughout the book, but what it's really about is a big wind-up punch. The book tells you from the start, it's gonna go wrong. It shows you a clenched fist and says, you're gonna be sad. And then it spends the whole book being like, whoa, oh, it's coming. It's coming. Why would I attack Hector? He's done nothing to me. Oh, you ready for it? It's coming. And you spend 400 pages wincing, being like, oh, I'm gonna get punched. I'm gonna get punched. And then you do get punched and there's nothing you can do about it. And it's horrible. This book is like constantly being jabbed or poked the whole time.
That...
And it's not as effective as the wind-up punch.
I absolutely love that metaphor. Completely derail me doing the explanations, but you're right. Like you said to me, talk to Jad, like, to me, if you want to use that metaphor, this is like the character Cersei is like on the street, and every random person that walks past just gives you a quick slap in the face. And as soon as you're going, ow, like, what was that? Before you even finish, like, what was that for? The next person comes along and just slaps you again. And then again. And
that's
again.
Right.
Until eventually you're just in the...
Exactly.
You'll get into fetal position eventually. And that's what happens here. Cersei is a god, but she gets involved with magic she shouldn't have, and she is banished for eternity to an island to live in isolation. And people rock up, people from the Odyssey and other Greek myths, and they show up, and most of the time she tries to be nice and they're mean to her and it goes a bit wrong and then they leave. And this format goes on a bit until we get to the end and things are mildly happier-ish. Okay, that's a good summary. Yeah,
that's good. That's a pretty good summary, Duncan.
Jordy, can I tell you my thoughts on this? I know you should said yours. Cersei, everyone, I have such high thoughts. I read this before Song of Achilles. And when I read Song of Achilles, my main thought was, damn, that blew Cersei out of the water for me. Cersei is a well-written book. It's a well-researched book.
It sure is, no doubt.
With really, actually, you know, well-developed characters. But as... I think Jordy alluded to for himself, same for me, just the emotional connection was just not as strong as I had in Song of Achilles. And I'm not quite sure, I think we've just explained it a little bit, why that might have been the point. But it just didn't click. I didn't empathise or sympathise to the same level as Song of Achilles. That said, I do want to make this very clear. Song of Achilles, we put on one of the highest totems that we have on this podcast. It is one of the absolute finest.
It's tied for the best book that we've read on the entire podcast so far.
So that's pretty, you know, if I'm saying it wasn't as good as that, there's still a long way between there and bad. This is definitely not bad. In fact, I don't know about you, Geordie, but the other Troy book we've read, Secret of the Gales, I would still put this slightly ahead of that book. Maybe not by an awful lot. But I still would.
Yeah, probably. I think I would. The thing about this book, Duncan, is that what it shares in common with Song of Achilles is that Madeline Miller is a beautiful writer.
It's so poetic. There are just some descriptions, particularly on the island, when things are being nice and it's about the flowers and the blue sea and the sun above. It's gorgeous. The painting of these scenes is absolutely lovely. It makes you kind of, despite how horrible the world is, want to step onto that beautiful, idyllic Greek island, often done in contrast to the horrific events that are occurring.
Absolutely. And there's something really interesting about the theme of that book, which is that this is a book about isolation. First and foremost, you know, that's what it's about. And it's about isolation, but it's not really about loneliness. That plays into it at certain points. But really, it's a story about the pleasures that come with being alone. And that's something which I can definitely connect with. You know, I'm someone who... I need space away from people sometimes. I just came back from a solo hiking trip, you know? I don't have anyone else in my life who's interested in going with me on a 150-kilometer trek across Sweden. But that time to myself... Even though there were many, many times when I was out, I was like, I miss people. I wish they were here. The time spent by myself, acting under my own power, relying only upon myself, is extremely rewarding and peaceful.
And I was just going to find out, obviously, I'm a very different human being. You know, I went to a festival. I was surrounded by human beings. But I also, what really like about this book is that you talk about isolation. Yes, it's the physical isolation of the island, but there's the isolation early on in the book where she's at her father's court. So how I'm going to describe it, he lost his court, and she's still isolated, but isolated, surrounded by people. And
exactly
what I think so beautiful is, like,
she's ostracized in that group. She's othered while surrounded by people. So when she's separated from them, there's actual tangible distance. That isolation, it becomes real. And instead of being clamoring isolation, where you are shut up by the silence of noise, where your voice has no impact and no one will hear you, when you are literally alone and no one can hear you except for yourself, well, what can Kirky do? But she can sing to herself.
And I love the fact that she kind of comes into her own power then. It's this story, and I would say that's the running narrative. Like, this book is quite episodic, and I do want to explore each of the episodes individually as we go, because some of them I absolutely love. But as a sort of overall, this is her character. This book is her character development.
Sure.
From wanting to be included in the crowd, to being physically, but you know, ostracized from it, to being physically isolated from it, but then coming into her own power and going, actually, I'm happy where I stand. I do miss people and a level of interaction, and she does enjoy when she does interact, but she knows that she can survive and manage on her own, and she does.
Yeah, there's something about this book which I, at a certain point, I almost wanted to call it cottage core power fantasy. And it's about, you know, she becomes a witch. She starts learning how to use herbs and doing magic through, like, you know, classic witchcraft stuff, like brewing and mixing up different plants and that. And what I found really interesting about it is that there's a very deliberate emphasis on the fact that her power comes from traditionally feminine arts. You know, like, this is very deliberately saying stuff which men are not interested in and they don't find value in is the thing that makes her stronger than various gods.
And there's something about that, particularly in the way, you know, we talk about she's a, you know, a witch. I referenced earlier the court. This story, although it is so deeply rooted in, obviously, the Greek mythos, it is a story that I feel like could be very easily retold in, like, you know, a medieval setting with, you know, a more classic medieval witch, ostracized, and people come to the cottage. But that story of self-empowerment and working outside of society can be taken again and again and again. Obviously, I think the whole of Greek myths can be praised for that, that you can retell these stories in different settings and they still fundamentally work.
Yeah, I mean, Daedalus and Icarus, who are important characters in this book, are so monumentally iconic that people who have absolutely no interest in Greek mythology not only know the story, like, the back of their hands, but they also incorporate it into all sorts of other stories. Like, the theme of, like, the word Icarus, it has a meaning onto itself now. It barely even attaches itself to a story.
Yeah, and I think the phrase flying too close to the sun,
absolutely,
is almost just a part of normal lingo. We all know what you were messing up there. Yes, so
let's break down the different episodes. I think they really come down to, aside from the very beginning of a story where it's her childhood, like, that is a part of a story, but it's not really worth focusing on too much because we've already covered the main theme, which is that people are jerks. But then I think that you have to sort of focus on the, I've already forgotten his name, Glaucus, the Glaucus story, and the Scylla story, which is connected to that, that leads to her isolation. You have her being by herself, and the introduction of Hermes, so I guess that's another section. There's the Minotaur, there's Medea, there's the sailors, there's Odysseus, and then that's basically part three, is just post-Odysseus part of a story.
Quite right, and kind of moving towards sort of the conclusion. So the Glaucus and Scylla, I think, you know, this is a real kickoff event. This is what gets Circe out into the world. And as you said, Jordy, it wasn't apparently part of her original myth. This is kind of pulling another story, another source, and incorporating Circe into it. Mm-hmm. But fundamentally, this story of a human fisherman who meets Cersei, doesn't know she's a god, loves her, but Cersei's sad, she can't be with him forever. What can she do? She'll use the deep magics and she'll make him a god. And he becomes
doesn't know she has these powers. This is sort of how she discovers that she has them. She makes a wish come true and she turns him into a god of the sea, a Nereid.
And what does the arsehole do? He leaves her for someone else.
Yes, he does the classic second act of a rock and roll movie. He's made it big. He's forgotten where he comes from.
Now, I suppose what's quite interesting here, just want to pick on the theme here. Cersei gets really angry at this and she takes out, I don't think she takes out fully on him. She takes out on the person that he like leaves her for, Scylla.
He's interested in Scylla, a nymph from Helios' court.
And she takes her vengeance on Scylla by transforming her into an iconic monster from the Greek myths. I believe this is part of Jason's story from like the Clashing Rocks. What's it called again?
It's the Odyssey.
Is it from the Odyssey?
It is from the Odyssey.
I've watched too much of Jason and the Argonauts. And I think it's from there.
I don't think they feature in Jason and the Argonauts. That might be just in the movie version.
What actually is it called? Is it called Scylla?
Scylla and Charybdis. Yes. Scylla is the dog-headed serpent monster in the High Cliff. And Charybdis is like this evil, evil whirlpool that sucks in ships. But she isn't actually named in this book. She's not called Charybdis. It's just a regular whirlpool.
So what Duncan is referring to is the Symplegades, I think is pronounced, from Jason and the Argonauts. I hadn't realized that he was asking me like what it was called. And so, yeah, that's it. The Symplegades, the Clashing Rocks, which are these two cliffs that just like smash into each other and squish any ships that happen to come through.
Interesting. But sorry, I've just remembered. I'm thinking of Percy Jackson and the Sea of Monsters.
Okay, well, now we're getting somewhere.
That's my education in Greek myths. Yes. And what I really like about this is that Cersei is not, obviously this is the event that gets her banished from the court for doing this horrific thing and talking about it because she touched the deep magic. But she's shown us to be wrong about this.
Oh, yeah.
You know, she should have taken that on Scylla. And also Glaucus, despite the fact that obviously he's living up. Glucose, yep. Good old looking after the diabetics there. Despite the fact that we, as a reader, sympathise with Cersei, and you're like, oh, you arse. There's also this, there is a bit of a layer here, Jordy, where you're like, well, he didn't ask her to make him immortal. And also, just because someone makes you immortal doesn't mean you owe them eternity.
He also doesn't know.
Yes.
He doesn't know that she made him immortal. She hides that from him. They believe, she tells him that it was just his fate, that he was destined to become a god, and everyone else agrees, yes, it was destiny, and it must be it, because there's no way for a mortal to become a god, except for all the times that it happens.
I swear Zeus just has like a magic pot of nectar. He's just like, here, have a jug of that.
The classic thing is that they're like, yeah, we'll turn you into a god, we will. Turn him into stars, turn him into a constellation, we don't want to add any more gods.
So, you know, he's like, well, you haven't actually done something wrong. And also the fact that she doesn't express her emotions at all, and she just takes them out violently on, again, a bit of an ass, but ultimately a sort of an innocent party. It's clearly displayed as wrong, and I think it really gets you on this interesting foot where you're like, Cersei has done something wrong. Cersei is not necessarily a good person. She's not as bad as a lot of the other
Yes, she's lashed out in anger and transformed someone into what she thinks they are. So she believes at first that her powers of transformation, again, to begin with, she doesn't think that they are her powers. She thinks they're the powers of some magical plants. She thinks what they do is they reveal the true form of something. So she believes that Glaucus, you know, deep down, he is noble enough to be a god. So when he lays down in these flowers, he becomes a god. And that proves her theory correct. And so she believes that when she scatters these same flowers upon Scylla's river or stream or what have you, it turns her into this hideous monster. Well, that just reveals that deep down she was a monster. But no, that's not what it does. It reveals only her perception of what they are. She transforms people into what she believes they are deep down. which is, of course, going to be very relevant when it comes to sailors later in the story.
It is indeed. And I think it's nice not to have Circe as just a pure good soul. Obviously, that wouldn't gel with her most famous story in the Odyssey. And I also think it's quite nice where I don't, or at least I think at this point in the novel, I don't look at this as, oh, this is just the horrible world getting to her. Like, there's a bit in her which still has a bit of a mean streak that still lashes out. And that's something that she has to overcome.
Yeah. She's transformed someone against her will, just like all the other Greek gods. You know, deep down, she's done the exact same thing that she condemns a lot of them for.
And that's really good. That gives her a place to work from and not be 100% misunderstood or 100% this is a good person, it's the world that's corrupting them. Because I think I wouldn't have found that nearly as engaging. So I'm very happy that this sort of decision was made. And I know if this wasn't part of her story, I think it's really great to attach it to her in this book. Because it kind of sets us up on this arc for her to have while she's on the island.
Yes, exactly. And once she is on the island, as we've said, you know, there's this really beautiful part where she is basically completely by herself. And it becomes about this character, you know, learning to live by herself. And she comes to her own power through explorations in witchcraft. And then a very interesting change is made to the story, which is that Hermes is introduced as her main confidant.
Yes, he is. And Hermes is an interesting character. Obviously, I'm most familiar with him in his characterization in the Percy Jackson books. So,
yes, of course.
It's been nice to see him here. He's introduced as her confidant. I basically felt this entire book, like, and possibly quite rightfully, never really trusted Hermes. It just felt like...
That's prudent and wise, Duncan.
So it's just like, you are just like all the others. I'm confident you are. You are. You might not be showing it, but I am very confident you are not a nice guy deep, 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 deep down. Or maybe you are, but it is very deep.
Hermes is such a classic character because he's an archetypical trickster character. And, you know, if you've read your... I wish I could remember his name. It's my first year of study at university. But there was this fella. I might look him up during whilst I'm editing this.
I was referring to Lewis Hyde's work, Trickster Makes This World, Myth, Mischief, and Art.
But he said of characters like Hermes and Mercury and Loki and the hare in certain Indian American mythologies, that they are the characters who make the world more interesting. They break the rules, and in doing so, they invent the world anew. So Hermes has always been this really iconic and persevering character. You know, he shows up so often in modern iconography, far more than even Zeus. You know, he's so he sticks with people because he's interesting and he's fascinating and he's adaptable as a character, someone we want to see explored because he is puckish and roguish, and he has maybe a dark edge to him. He's the god who protects travelers and doctors, but he's also the god of thieves.
It's that, and I think those kind of characteristics then lead into his often again characterized with a lot of charisma,
which is appropriate for the story.
Exactly. And also, I feel like because he's not the guy on top, you know, you feel like he doesn't have this much of a daily function. He is fun to see him. Like, he can move into different modes, and he clearly has sort of more different personalities that come forth. But obviously, back to where he is in Circe, you say a confidant, a little bit more than just a confidant, Geordie.
Yes. So he's also her lover. Their relationship is really interesting and strange because, like you, Duncan, she enjoys Hermes' company. For one thing, he's the only person visiting her, period, because he's the messenger. But also, you can't trust him at all. And she knows that I used the word confidant because I was leading into this. But actually, he's not a confidant at all. Because everything he tells her, he spreads around. He's a total gossip. You know, she knows that he leaves him and he spins like the worst possible image of her across across Mount Olympus and in the realms of the Titans. And she just doesn't care. She puts it behind her. She needs his company. She enjoys his company. She enjoys having sex with him. So she puts up with it.
I mean, to be fair, this isn't actually like one of the low points in the story. We talk about consistent slaps in the face. This is probably one of the milder hits that she has.
Yeah, for sure. I barely even register this one.
But Geordie, This is, you know, this is a very short lift. This is, like I said, this is one of the more of the episodes.
Yes, but I will say that what it did set up for me, and I like this. This is the first proper. This is a wind up punch. I wouldn't say it lands that hard, but when Hermes is introduced as her one person she can like reliably talk to, and that she can, you know, that she, not trust, but you know, but she can have nearby, that someone she can rely upon to talk to and to hear her, knowing that it's Hermes who's going to betray her to Odysseus, that's the first wind up punch in this book. I'm like, okay, right, way ahead of time. You've set up for a disaster to happen. She is going to be betrayed. Ultimately, that punch just doesn't land because at that point in the story, she's been betrayed so many times that I guess she just doesn't care anymore. She's just like, oh, I was betrayed. Well, so it goes. So you don't get the full
impact. Very much how I felt. It's one of those things, talking about a wind-up, like, you're like, okay, we're going to hit you with this later. And then you proceed to get such a battering, you're already on the ground. And then they just come up and give you a little kick. Doesn't have the oomph. What I really did like, though, and one of my bits, well, I really think I stepped up into... Not that I wasn't liking the book, but my liking of this book went up a notch at this next stage. And that's when Daedalus steps in.
Yes, I definitely enjoyed Daedalus as a presence. Again, there's a reason why people are so hooked on the story of Icarus. People are fascinated by this character. And Daedalus stands out a lot in the canon of Greek myths, just like Odysseus, because he's a hero who's clever. He's not strong and brave. He's not exactly a hero either, but he stands out very significantly.
Exactly. And for those who don't know a little bit about Daedalus, I love how this book puts across one of the things that he does, and we all know he does this, it's in the myths, it's in the stories, but when you have actual characters speaking out this section, oh, Geordie, stomach turning. Because Daedalus has been sent by Circe's sister, the Queen of Crete, wife to King Minos, and I will try and pronounce her name. Circe's sister, Queen of Crete, is Pasiphaea.
I've got it here in front of me as Pasiphaea.
Pasiphaea, lovely. Pasiphaea, the one who burst the Minotaur. And Geordie, when they describe the fact that Daedalus, the great inventor, made her a cow costume.
Yep.
All this was stomach turning. Bestiality. No.
Listen, man.
No.
Greek myths are just not for you, because that is like, I don't know, the fourth biggest instance of it. In the myth, in I think it was Ovid's version of the myth of Arachne, it's just Arachne paints a bunch of the different times where Zeus has raped women in the forms of animals, and one of them is in the form of a grape.
Sorry?
Yeah. Listen, my year 11 ancient history class really tried to puzzle that one out. We never got an answer.
Just hands in the air, sir. How?
Yes, we were all doing that. Also, definitely the earliest Pickle Rick joke. I'm sorry, that's terrible.
Disgusting. Right. Yeah, this is a really something to any scene. I love the birthing of the Minotaur that Pasiphaea gives birth to. Circe's
brought
in
as a midwife.
Yeah,
that was fucked up. Holy Prometheus by Ridley Scott. Not Prometheus, who's also in this book. Batman. That was so gross.
I think this is a really great scene, though, because you're talking about fulfilling sort of traditional women's roles in society. Circe's the midwife.
Yeah, yeah.
Hardcore midwifery.
Very hardcore. Berserk level midwifery.
But despite the fact that she bursts a flesh-eating monster that kills people right off the bat and takes several fingers, the Minotaur, I really like the fact that she does do like the midwifery job. She hates her sister. She's birthing a demon, but she's like, okay, I'm going to get this baby out of you. I'm going to make sure you don't die. I'm going to make sure it doesn't die. This will not be easy.
I think it's sad that they think the baby Minotaur is ugly, because I've seen some drawings of baby Minotaurs and they look pretty adorable. Think about it. Think about a little calf on a toddler's body. Isn't that adorable?
Yeah, I think it kind of is too. I'm like, yeah, calves are cute. Babies are cute.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't they be cute?
Bingo bango. I think that baby should be loved and cherished. And not immediately put into a sack.
I agree with you, Geordie. Also, though, I've never understood, like, because the Minotaur is, like, this flesh-eating monster. And I'm like, but aren't bulls herbivores?
Not all of them are herbivores in Greek mythology. Remind me to tell you about Diomedes' horses.
Okay. Another day. I'm scared. So we have this really strong scene for her. And I love it. I also really like the fact that Daedalus in this scene... Geordie, when I first read this book, I'll be honest with you, I'd half forgotten who Daedalus was. I was like, yep, chill. And then there's this scene later where little kid Icarus comes running in and I go, oh, I remember now who you are.
Oh, you got wind-up punched. I guess that one's more of a rabbit punch. You got sneak attacked.
Really effective. And also, like, you take these mythological characters, but once you connect them, particularly I think connecting with Daedalus over Icarus, you're like, oh, no, I know the pain you're going to go through. And what I also thought was really interesting in this story is that actually that, you know, the story of Daedalus and Icarus, we kind of jump over. It's a bit of a time skip for Circe. She goes back to her island after birthing the Minotaur.
Yes.
And she sort of just hears about it later. And I thought...
Yes, I wanted to bring it up, but you had just brought up Daedalus and I didn't want to interrupt. But actually... Hermes' role in the story is really specific, which is that he's the exposition guy. So this story covers centuries passing, well, millennia passing, but the part of her being on the island covers centuries, and they go for a bunch of different ancient Greek heroes. And Hermes is the guy who's going to fill in the gaps. After those characters are dead and gone, and they've left the island, and Circe can't possibly learn about them... And her, like, going to visit the Minotaur on Crete is, like, a very special exception where she's let off her island. For the rest of the story, for the most part, until the very end, she never leaves.
But what I love about this is that I think it helps keep the story really laser focused on Circe. Like, we're not going to go off and have any interactions or see things from Daedalus's perspective. Although I would love to read it in Madame Miller's voice, like... She's an excellent
yes,
author.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly what I thought when we got to the Medea section of the book. I was worried to begin with that when Circe... Unfortunately, Duncan, I've been hoodwinked because I've been saying Kirky for weeks and weeks and weeks and leading up to this, but now I'm talking about you and I'm going on autopilot. I've succumbed to peer pressure. When Kirky is talking to Medea about the horrible adventures she's been on, slicing up her little brother, I was really being like, oh man, does this mean we're not going to get Madeline Miller's version of Medea? Because I legitimately think it would be perfect for her. It's a dark, sad story where it really changes depending on whose character you see it from. The story of Jason and Medea told from Jason's perspective, and Medea is pure evil and a psycho. But if you do it from Medea's perspective and from an ancient Greek perspective, she's actually kind of the only one who's following the rules.
Again, not overly familiar with what you're referring to. I think I know someone definitely murders someone else's kids, and they do end up divorced.
Jason and Medea have two daughters together.
This is incorrect. I was thinking of how Medea has two daughters kill their father in order to better Jason's chances of winning a throne. Because she's great. They actually have like a bunch of children depending on the story, between 2 and 14. Oh, but Medea also kills two of them, which might be what I was thinking of.
And they are neglected when Jason marries a more proper bride. Like, even though he's married still to Medea, they have not gotten divorced. And Hera is furious about this, and Hera is Jason's patron god. So Medea has his children murdered and, like, destroys his entire life. And she leaves and she escapes and she, like, is never actually harmed. Like, she doesn't get punished by the gods because she's been the one who's been following the rules, even though she, like, murders her own brother. It's all okay. It's all kosher. And then Jason has, like, the most depressing end for all Greek heroes, which is saying something. Which is that he returns to the Argonaut, you know, his boat. No, it's not the Argonaut. He returns to the Argo. He is an Argonaut. And he says, everyone has deserted me. All of my sailing friends have gone home. I've lost all the treasures that I sought. It was all for nothing. I lost both my wives. "You're my only friend." And then the masthead of the Argo breaks off, falls down, cracks him on the head, and he dies.
Oh, that is sad. That's not heroic. That is not noble. Oh.
Yeah, that dude sucked. And he's just straight up not a good hero. I'm sorry, I know you love Jason and the Argonauts, the movie, and I don't know how your version of that story ends, but I very much doubt it's like
no,
that.
No, quite famous, probably not actually, probably quite obscure by all accounts, that film ends on a, will there be a sequel? It literally ends on the happiest point of the story, where they set sail with the fleece in one hand, Medea on his arm, and he's like, let's go home. And then just roll credits.
So literally the exact second before everything goes wrong.
Completely. It's just the heroic bits. And they even cut out the murder of Medea's brother.
It's just like the Northern Lights movie, The Golden Compass.
Yes, Stuart, exactly like that. Except Jason the Argonauts is a fantastic movie, effects by Ray Harryhausen. I was obsessed as a nerdy teenager with stop motion animation. It didn't go anywhere, but it was a weird obsession. I had a few. Right. Mm. So yeah, I would love to see a story from Medea's side, but this isn't it. I like the fact that we stay laser focused on Cersei because, one, I think it super reflects her immortality. The fact that these other stories are just recounted sometimes centuries later and she's just going to go, oh,
yep.
Humans, am I right?
Yeah, she predicts that she's born before human beings exist.
So I think that's really well done. You mentioned Medea. That does bring us to the next sort of episode. They kind of have interaction. They stop off. She has a really nice chat with Medea. I think Cersei recognised Medea as a, I don't know.
As a witch.
Another witch, yeah. I was about to say like a sister.
Human witch.
Yeah. Someone that she, I think they have a connection. They're like, okay, we're both witches. We're both trying to get what we want. And I really like the fact that at this stage, now you've told me that information, Cersei can have this conversation with Medea, which is like, you can't trust him. You can't trust anyone. They're all going to betray you in the end. And Medea's like, no, Jason loves me. Thank you for telling me where that goes.
Yeah, I think Hermes does give you a Cliff Notes version where he says, and she went back to her dad, and I guess she wasn't in trouble or whatever. But, yeah, so that story, it serves as this moment of Kirky trying to act, you know, to... She's a sort of Cassandra figure in a lot of this book because no one will ever listen to her. Not even Odysseus will really listen to her when she comes to give him advice. And they will all end up paying for it. And that's, again, part of a dramatic irony. Even when she's in her own power, even when she's by herself, she can't be disrespected by everyone all over again. She's still neglected. She's still forgotten because she has wisdom to give, hard-earned knowledge, and no one wants it. No one wants to listen to her.
They're the half-truths, Geordie. Come on, let's listen to some nice, easy lies. You don't want to know that people are going to stop loving us and leave us.
You're right. We don't want to hear that.
Nope, but it doesn't mean it's not true. And I think... And you know what? I think... This sounds really awful. Oh. I don't want to say this. I think there are going to be different readers who may empathize with that in particular a lot more.
Sure.
I think
it's sure,
definitely
yeah.
Something where I was reading this, and maybe this is comparing it off as like someone with Achilles, where it's like, oh, this is really interesting. This isn't something that I personally can fully step into, but I think this has been portrayed really well. And I think as someone who maybe has felt this more in their life or feels that way at the moment, like this book could be a cathartic read to kind of see those emotions play out in a character and experience their whole story.
I think it's now worth getting into what I feel is... Now, I wasn't tracking this properly, but I reckon it's basically the second half of the book. And that is like the period of the book that leads directly up to the Odyssey. It covers her relationship with Odysseus and then the aftermath of the Odyssey. Do you think that's about 50%?
I think so. It's definitely 50% maybe page now, count. I don't know if it was 50% in like happening. I think things do slow down a lot because we're really playing out over a much...
Yes, they do. Literally, they slow down because millennia happen in the first half and then 20 years in the second?
Yeah, about that. Kids got to get older. They got to meet.
It does perturb me that we've spoken for an hour about the half of the book, which is not about what we want to talk about. and we normally do 80-minute episodes. So maybe I gotta cut out some of our talk about the Minotaur. But I guess it depends how much you want to talk about the stuff with Odysseus. I get, before we do that, though, we have to talk about content warnings. Hooray!
Yes, and it's very interesting to say, like, want to talk about. This is a very challenging bit of the book. Before Odysseus formally steps in, we have the sexual assault of Circe by a group of male sailors. In particular, I think it's their captain. I say sexual assault, rape. And it is a very hard thing to read. I think it was done very well.
Yeah, it was awful. It was a horrible, horrible scene.
I think Brandon Miller does a very good job, especially compared to other fictions that we've ever read, in terms of keeping this both...
focused on the victim.
Yes, focused on the victim. Things have a visceral feeling, but I don't think they're too explicitly graphic. And
yeah, I'd
focus
agree.
Heavily on not only obviously the emotional trauma of the event, but very much the latter half of this book is then, you know, exploring the character and from the fallout of it and how this impacts her. So
yes, because what you need to get from is you need to get from sympathetic Kirky, never did anything wrong, not really, except for that one time she made a monster out of Scylla. And now you need to turn her into, why is she turning everyone who visits her islands into pigs in the Odyssey? Because in the Odyssey, Kirky is one of the many villains that Odysseus faced on his journey. You have Cyclopses. You have other giants that eat people. You have Lotus Eaters. And now you've got a new one. You've got an evil witch who he has to outfox. And in a feminist retelling of that story, how do you reframe it? And the answer, it almost just rolls off the tongue. Like, the fact that Kirky turns men into pigs is so directly in line with, like, standard, like, blasé feminist language from the mid-20th century saying men are pigs as a sort of, a blasé throwaway way to express frustrations at the cruelty and the crassness of men. It just the stars align. It's so obvious.
And it links right back to the start of the novel. Circe's magic, she can transform people into what she thinks of their true selves, but it's how she views them. She thinks they're pigs. Exactly. She turns them into pigs.
And she kills them. She doesn't just turn them into pigs. She's explicitly... Now, I don't think she's literally eating them, but I do think she's feeding them to her cats.
Again, I wouldn't even call it cannibalism at this point. She's technically a god. They're technically a pig. You know, it's not really even a crossover at any point. But, yes.
Okay, Hannibal Lecter.
It's in the fine print, mate. So what counts? Now, how would I kind of talk about this? I think this does a really good job. I think the...
Yes, I think it's well done.
Yes, it's really hard because it was still hard to read. It was still challenging, but it was tasteful. And Madeline Miller, I think, I don't know how many times she rewrote this. Maybe it was all in one, but she fine-tunes it. I think she gets a good balance. And I think what's really nicely done is that we see what this does to Circe. We see how she responds. But also, going back to that early incident with Glaucus and Scylla, we see how in some points it drives her too far.
Exactly. Like, there are parts where Hermes asks her, or maybe it's Odysseus who asks her, how do you determine the good men from the bad? How do you know they deserve it? And she says, to be more specific, she makes a parachute for Kirky in saying, sometimes she can just tell they're not bad guys and she doesn't turn them into pigs. So she's saying, well, it's not all of them. It's just one she's suspicious of. But then there's parts where Odysseus says, within a crew, how do you know we're all bad guys? And she says, I don't know. And I don't care. I just do it.
I mean, our protagonist. And I think it's really interesting how, for me at least, this is how it made me feel. I can simultaneously be so empathetic to Circe and be like, I am 100% there with you. Why you have gotten to this point on your path. and at the same time be like, and that is a little bit too much. I love you.
Yeah.
I want to help you, but we've got to step back.
Doesn't it go to show how connected you can be to a character when they're extremely well written? But you can watch them do these deeply morally compromised things and still not be on their side. You can even say, I can empirically say that you have probably done a great deal of evil in this act because you fed people to pigs without technically knowing that they were going to harm you. And you had fuel to lions, excuse me. They were pigs. And then you think of characters like Rin from The Poppy War. And it's that, you know, something very similar is attempted to be done there. You're trying to show characters doing morally compromised acts, and you have to show them how they get to that point. And it purely comes down to, did you do a good job of writing this character and this story? Because if the answer is yes, you can basically have them get away with anything.
Well, I don't know about anything, but you're right. It's about taking on that journey. And I think the thing that we're for Cersei is that we do take the whole of the first half.
Duncan, do you remember The Women as Kings?
Yes.
The most destructive act we've seen in any story ever, right?
Okay, fair enough. All right, yes, you can get away with anything. Go and listen to Women as Kings. Someone literally... And generally in that novel, by the time we get to that short story, sorry, I was like, fair play. I'm with you.
Do you want me to keep that or do you want me to censor that and say... That was a huge spoiler. Go listen to our episode on The Women as Kings.
Definitely the second one. Censor that away.
I'll just do a full 35-second beep to cover all of that up.
So,
anyway,
we have this
Odysseus
scene,
arrives.
And Odysseus arrives. We're here, Geordie. It's Troy-ish.
Hooray, it counts.
So, Troy has happened. By the time Odysseus rocks up, that's how it works. Goes to Troy, and this is his journey home, and he shows up, and Cersei, she's on the pig turning path. That's her plan. Odysseus walks into the room. Now, in the classic story, Joe, I'm not quite sure how this plays down. You know, does he just get away? Does he outwit her? Like, how does he deal with her in that story?
So I will lay out the exact differences between this story, okay?
Go for it.
So in the Odyssey, he and his crew arrive on the island, and he says, you guys fan out and you go look for food and shelter. I'm going to stay with the ship for some reason. I don't remember if he sends out all his guys, or if he goes a nap, which he often does, or if he sends out some of his guys, but the point is that a bunch of his guys go out and they don't come back. And we know from the narrative of the story that they have been turned into pigs. A long time passes, Odysseus gets worried, he sets off to try and track down his men, and then in the forest, he's met by Hermes. He shows up and says, whoa, 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 listen up, okay? There's a witch in this wood called Kirke, she's turned your men into pigs, find this magical flower, eat it, and then her spell will not work on you, she won't be able to turn you into a pig. However, now he gives him really precise instructions. Take this herb, go to her house, and then let her cast a spell on you, and then produce your spear and threaten her. And then she'll be powerless, and you must take her to your bed, because then you'll have power over her, and she won't be able to harm you, and she'll turn your men back. And this is like explicit instructions given to him by a god, and he does all of this, and then he stays on the island for a year, and basically the rest of the stuff that happens in the book happens. Whereas, in this book, Odysseus shows up and he doesn't eat the flower. In the book, he doesn't trust Hermes enough, but it's also supposed to show that he isn't planning on conquering Kirke through brute force. It shows that he's this gentler, softer soul, and he's not come to outwit her. He's come to just be nice, to just ask in a cool, calm way that she will let, you know, she'll turn his men back into human beings.
Odysseus, cool guy when he wants to be.
So now there's a very interesting thing that happens. We get Odysseus, who was an important character within Song of Achilles, and he's depicted quite differently. He's clever in both books, but it suddenly became very obvious the ways in which the perspective character of Kirke, who's the one telling this story, and Patroclus in Song of Achilles really had different relationships with Odysseus. I remember thinking, whilst reading Song of Achilles, I can't believe that Madeline Miller would ever write a story about Odysseus and Kirke if this is how she depicts Odysseus, because he's a jerk and he's pretty awful. He's violent and he's cruel and he's kind of heartless. I don't like him at all in this. And that's sad, because Odysseus is one of my favorite characters in all of fiction. But in this, he's suave and he's debonair and he's sensitive and he's sad. He's deeply, deeply sad.
It's very interesting. It's something that I really noticed when we went and read Song of Achilles. He's a different character. Or at the very least, Madeline Miller is using her sort of perspective license, saying that we're seeing him through Circe's eyes, as opposed to the eyes of the characters in Song of Achilles, to make him a very different
character.
She
calls it out explicitly. There's a bit where Odysseus says, Achilles went a bit crazy after he lost his lover, Patroclus. He didn't like me much.
And that's nice, because I like the idea that this is still a shared Madeline Miller universe for sort of Greek mythology. If we didn't have anything, I'd just be like, oh, is this just another one? Or are these linked? Come on, this is the same universe. Keep it together. So
it is. It absolutely is.
Very happy about that. And yeah, he is nice. He is the first genuinely nice guy-ish. I really want to keep saying ish and maybe and kinda.
Yeah, okay, we'll get to that later. But so there's this really interesting change that happens here, which is it dramatically changes Odysseus's 1 year stay on her island. Now, if you have ever read the Odyssey and you've talked about it like in a classroom setting, there is a very understandable modern impulse to go, okay, so Odysseus is our hero. And his whole mission is he wants to get home, and he loves his wife, and he wants to get back to his wife. But he stays on Kirke's island for a year, and he sleeps with her all the time, and he's being unfaithful, and he's not trying to get home. What's up with that? And the actual answer is, yeah, this is a Greek myth. They thought that was fine. Him staying for a year is weird, but him sleeping with a woman is justified in the text, and it was just, like, fine. Like, she's basically his property after he's won.
Yep, an uncomfortable version of the Greek myth, but that, hence why I'm very happy we get these sort of reimaginings.
Exactly, and it is reimagined, because a clear thing that she's trying to do here is that she is fighting with the source material. Just like in the section where she says he doesn't eat the herb, he just like talks to her and he's nice to her and he's kind. And importantly, she invites him to her bed, like it's in her power. This is an act of reclamation of herself and her sexuality. Odysseus's decision to stay and his relationship to Kirke is really fascinating. And it's probably the most interesting part of the book, because you see in ways in which he's doing this just because he's afraid. He's afraid to go back to Ithaca, and he's using the domesticity of living on her island to be as practice to say, yes, I remember what it's like to be at home and not at war, or in a absolutely insane ship, you know, journey by ship.
Very much so, and I think there's also the relationship with him and Circe. Again, it develops it more. He clearly is shown to having far more genuine feelings towards her.
Uh-huh.
And I think and I like that. I like the fact that we finally get this moment of no slap in the face for a second. One person passes you on the street and doesn't hit you. Not ominous at all. For what comes up next. And in this time frame, we then...
Oh, God, so sad.
Frame then, we also get the fact that Circe becomes pregnant with Odysseus's one of Odysseus's sons, Telegonus. I'm gonna say
this dude is he's so minor in the mythos that I genuinely do forget that, yeah, I'm pretty sure this guy does exist, but he's so minor and so small in the canon that I'm like, does he exist? Did she make him up?
I can tell you now, he has a Wikipedia page, so he must exist.
Yeah.
That's genuinely...
And the reason why I feel like he doesn't get brought up a lot is that he's a bummer.
As in, he is very
to
sad.
To go over this...
story.
Yes, to go over this ever so briefly. Because, I'm just going to say this, he's not an interesting character.
He's...
In fact, he's genuinely a bit annoying.
To be fair, he just kind of represents so many of what all the other heroes have been. As in, I think...
But just a dumb fuck. I know this book is sort of about... Like, it's a book about being a woman. And therefore, there are parts that are just, I'm not gonna grok. Because one, I'm not a parent. And two, I'm especially not a mother. So I... And three, I'm not a single mother, which is essentially what this section of a book is about. It's about what a nightmare it is to be a single mother, especially when you're alone on an island and for some reason you sent all the nymphs away. And also the goddess Athena wants to kill your baby. That sounds really rough. And yeah, it's about how hard it is to be a mum, to be terrified that you're fucking up your kid.
It's so much like one of the previous section of this book where I explained it as like, I love how this is written. I'm sure this is doing an excellent job. I have so little personal life experience. Just like the, you know, the sort of being like the not being listened to elements, like, I'm sure you're capturing this really well. I just got to have faith you're doing
exactly.
It. But I'm still empathising with the character. I still have sympathy for the character. So you're still doing a good job for your story. We're just not having that final click.
And it's not like I can't relate to stories of mothers. I love the fifth season and all of that trilogy, which is about the fraught relationship between mothers and daughters. I love the Pixar short Bao. I'm the only person I know who does.
No, it's amazing. And when I first watched that before Incredibles 2, I was like, this, we ain't topping this.
It's so good. It's beautiful.
She eats the Bao bun. Oh, I was yeah. Shocked. Jump to my seat.
I know. Gasps in the cinema. What was I saying before we talked about Bao?
We can relate to stories.
Like, it goes on for a bit. Telegonus is a bit annoying because he's a brat and he doesn't understand what danger is in. He's a dumb fuck. But also, he's a bummer because he leads into a part of a book which I just forget about when I think about the myth of... Well, not the myth, the poem of Odysseus, which is that he dies. And Odysseus was such an important, ever-present character when I was a boy, and long before I'd read the Odyssey, which is a challenge, long before I'd read it, I'd listened to like a bunch of different shorter abridged audio versions of it, which were beautiful and they were full of great music. And it made it more appropriate for listening to as a kid. And they do not go to the bit where he dies.
Geordie.
Tragically and pathetically.
Pointlessly. I remember so clearly when we did Song of Achilles and you said these words, and I'm sure they're recorded, obviously, so you can go back and check. You said, and so the Age of Heroes ends when Odysseus gets home and hangs up his cap. That is it. That's the end. And I've never just
Shit,
been like...
I did say that. You're right.
Oh, no. I've read Circe. Definitely goes on a bit longer. Definitely not good.
Well, good for you for keeping that to yourself for a year. And to be honest, this whole section alone kind of makes me wish I didn't read Kirky. Because I hate it. It's so sad.
It's the ending of so many of the Greek myths. Like, even... You talked about, you know, Jason has an unfortunate end. Odysseus, what I really love is leading up to the fact that obviously he dies. I like the fact that in this, in Cersei, we hear about the fact that he, you know, he struggled. Despite practicing on the island, he struggled to hang up his adventurous cap. You know?
Yeah, that was awful. Like, him as Vietnam vet Odysseus, like, in a constant state of paranoia and violence. It felt like such a betrayal of the image of Odysseus's return home that I had built up. To me, Odysseus has always represented the ultimate struggler, you know? As much as a character like, say, Guts, like someone who has to keep fighting and fighting and fighting and suffering to just try and get one thing, which is to go home and see his wife and his son and his dog, only to suffer again and again and again and be denied. The fact that he does get to go home and he does get to rule over his kingdom and he does get his wife back was so beautiful and profound to me that any other ending feels like a genuine betrayal of such an important story in my life. It would be like if I found out that Willy Wonka just threw Charlie Bucket out of that elevator.
Oh, I mean...
Or I guess if I just read the next book that came after, because apparently it's bad.
Oh, Willy Wonka and the Great... No, Charlie and the Great Glass Elevator. It's...
Yes.
Mate, it's weird. They go to outer space. They talk to the President of America. They fight aliens. It's insane.
I've no time for that.
Right, yes. It's really sad, and it definitely puts a melancholy end on another Greek hero, which obviously so many of them had. I'm sorry it did so much to destroy your image of him, like the only heroic one who doesn't end up, you know, he gets his normal life. But it does transition us into the next part of this plot, moving towards the end of Cersei. Cersei has to deal with the fact that Odysseus is dead. He's killed, sorry, I don't think we made it clear, he's killed by his son, Telegnogos, I'm going to go with. Because she sends Telegnogos off to meet his father, complications ensues, and he stabs Odysseus with a magic spear.
Yeah, the super-duper poisonous spear, which is the way all good heroes should die. And then Penelope, Odysseus' wife, and Telemachus flee to her island for reasons. I think Telemachus is afraid that he'll be blamed for his father's death for some reason. But the real reason is Penelope is like, Athena, the patron of Odysseus, will want Telemachus to take his father's place as the great hero, the great strategist. And so she flees to this island because Kirke has made it so that Athena cannot enter this island, so that she cannot kill her child because he was destined to kill Odysseus.
I'll be honest, at this particular point, I do feel like the emotional resonance gets a little lost with a little bit of too much maneuvering of characters.
Yeah, it slows down a bit here.
Particularly compared to the rest of the book, the entire rest of the book, where we keep it so laser focused on Cersei and her, like, her emotional story and her character growth, this gets a little wibbly wobbly. But to vaguely sum up, Cersei's son by Odysseus, it takes Athena's offer and goes off to do adventuring, and Cersei gets a liking to Odysseus's other son by Penelope, and Cersei goes off to, oh, her banishment ends. Honestly, I'm saying it so blasé because for me it was really blasé.
It's like the end of Red Dead Redemption. Not Red Dead Redemption. It's like the end of, what the fuck's that book called? Stephen King, it's about a prison. Shawshank Redemption. The Shawshank Redemption, where he's like, I would like to leave prison now. And they say, yeah, all right. And he does.
Great moments. And it just gives up. She blackmails her dad. He speaks to Zeus. There's this whole bit where she's like, Helios, you were always looking down on me, even when everything was going awful. Anyway, she goes off. And we have what I actually think is the emotional strong point of the story. She goes to deal with Scylla. And this is the bit where she realises her mistakes. We've said it before, she goes too far, she lashes out at the wrong people, she's not really turning them into what they are, what she thinks they are, and she finally recognises it.
And
she doesn't turn Scylla back, turns her to stone, but that's Greek myth for you.
If there's ever an insurmountable problem in Greek mythology, you should just turn someone into stone. Worked for Perseus. Just do it all the time. I don't know what happened to Medusa's head, it's got to be kicking around somewhere.
I would love to know what the canon is, where Medusa's head went after that.
After she turns Scylla to stone and she puts her great sin to rest, you know, now she's free. She can do as she pleases. And she and Telemachus are free together. He's freed of her destiny. She's free of her imprisonment. And then, for some reason, they become a couple.
This feels very out of place. I will say,
this feels
apparently
really fetishy.
So this is apparently, this is in the myth. So Cersei gets
is it
with
now?
Yes. Apparently this is
really
it. This is part of the original story, and you never guess what else. Who do you think Odysseus's son by Cersei ends up with?
God, I really couldn't. Not Penelope.
Yes, Penelope.
What? No! That's
in
gross.
In some accounts, Telemachus took to wife Odysseus' widow, Penelope.
That's disgusting. That's Pornhub shit. What the hell?
That's Greek mythology, people.
Worse than
Bestiality?
No, you're right, it's not. But anyway.
anyway, how do you move on from that, Geordie? So then that's the end of Cersei. No, there's one other.
Yeah, no, it's not the end of Cersei, Kirky, because the last thing that happens is a really beautiful part. Kirky and Telemachus agree they're going to travel the world / the Mediterranean together. They're going to go to Egypt. They're going to go to, they call it, it's not Arabia, they call it like an antiquated name. Arabine or something. And they're going to go see the world. And Kirky performs one last rite. She concocts this potion, and then the narrative changes. This whole time it's been first person past tense from her own perspective, looking back at her life. For in the first opening words, it's all about her recollection. And now we go back to the moment of that recollection. And it becomes future tense. It becomes her vision of the future. Perhaps a literal prophetic vision. She does have prophetic visions. We know that. That's canon. So maybe this is what shall happen, or maybe this is her wish for what will happen. And maybe, as she casts her final spell to turn herself mortal, we see a glimpse of what her life will be as a mortal woman. As a mother, she and Telemachus raising their children together and going on their journeys in a hard, difficult life that will end someday, and her old friend and lover Hermes will at last deliver her as the psychopomp down into the underworld to meet again with all those who have gone before.
It's a really good kicker of an ending. It's a great
mirror
to the Glaukos near the beginning, where she was in love with a mortal and wanted to turn him into a god. Her accepting, like her deciding to become a mortal, sort of like a self-empowerment. You know, she didn't fit in. She just hadn't enjoyed the role she was put in taking this massive on-surface sacrifice, but to live as a mortal woman, and how that is so, you know, that's what she wants. That's great for her, is amazing. And the fact that we talked about in the story, the fact that so many characters, because it spans millennia, die over the course of the story. Daedalus, Medea, the fact that it's like, well, how do you be with these mortals again? You become mortal and you go and join them in the afterlife, and it is really beautiful.
Just like I've forgotten her name. Arwen. It's a beautiful end. I love it. I'll tell you how I thought the book was going to end. You want to hear?
Go for it.
Kirky in modern day. Like, literally, interview with a vampire style. She's an immortal being. She has lived to see all of ancient Greece fall away and be replaced by Rome. And then the fall of Rome. And then the rise of, like, various powers. And, yeah, she's, like, looking back on it from the current day. And she's, like, still here. And she's still a strange witch wandering the world. But no, or still on her island, maybe. But no, that's not how it shook up in the end.
I think I would love that as an ongoing series. What am I saying? Obviously,
no,
I would love
no,
that, Greek that, myth characters no. in the modern world.
Yeah, I figured you would, Duncan. In fact, maybe it could focus on, like, plucky teenagers.
The final quote. All my life, I have been moving forward, and now I am here. I have a mortal voice. Let me have the rest. I live... I lift the brimming bowl to my lips and drink. It's beautiful and it's poetic, and it didn't resonate with me quite as much as Song of Achilles.
No. And you can say the whole thing for the whole book. You know, I said before, Song of Achilles is beautiful because it's that wind-up punch. You know how it's going to end. It's just like Hades Town. You know, it's a tragedy. We know it's a tragedy. We know how it's going to end. We're going to sing it anyway. And that book made me cry, and I never came close to crying in this book. I felt deep sadness at the sections that relate to post-Vietnam vet Odysseus. But it was also mingled with a frustration, which diluted that potent sadness. I wasn't able to actually, like, connect to the experiences of the characters, to Odysseus and to Circe and to Telemachus, because I was distracted by the fact that I really didn't want to engage with this new idea of Odysseus. It made me unhappy, but more so it made me kind of reject the story because I wanted to put my fingers in my ears.
In some respects, that's something that I also felt, maybe not around Odysseus, but around Circe's experience. You know, there are so many points where I get so kind of upset for this character that I almost wanted to disengage because there was maybe not the balance for me of sort of, I don't know, niceness and unpleasantness. Hmm. It got a little bit too, and again, never stopped being beautiful, never stopped being poetic. Mandamir is doing an excellent job, but for me, it just swung a little bit the other way. I will say, I spoke to my sister, my little sister, she's also read both books. She is like Circe's bear, all the way. Oh, Duncan, how could you? It's incredible. I'm like, I completely see that. And I think it might just be a matter of which elements you personally kind of gel with or you hit resonate with.
Maybe this
with.
One's for the girlies and Song of Achilles resonates more with men because it's a book about men.
I kind of don't want to say it's that gender specific, but I'm not going to lie. It is my experience as a bloke. So maybe. Still well worth it, and I'm still very happy I've read Circe.
Well, I and you know what, I definitely recommend it as well. I want to make that totally clear. We 110% recommend Song of Achilles to everyone. I recommend this book as well, and I recommend it for everyone who is not sensitive about sexual violence in books, because it kind of hinges on that a lot, so you should go into it with some caution if you're worried about that. Duncan, there is no need for you to tell me what book we're doing next time because we both have already read it.
That we have, everyone, due to the nature of us having our holidays, I did tell Geordie ahead of time so that we could get, you know, we could get ahead of schedule, we could be prepared. And so the book that we have...
I read both of the books before Duncan had finished his reread of Circe.
That is quite true. And this one's quite a big one, people, so... Do buckle down if you want to read this in time for our next episode, because we are reading Brian McKellen's Promise of Blood.
First book in the Powder Mage trilogy.
Geordie, this has sat on my shelf for quite some time. I am so excited to hear your thoughts on it. Mine are still very much in the forming stages. This is a cut into, I'm going to say more maybe, the epic fantasy. This is a story of magic, of kingships, and of muskets and revolution and republics.
But it's also kind of like, I don't know, a Tom Clancy novel? Maybe a bit of an Expanse novel? Like, it really hits a different tenor from a lot of the other fantasy out there. Like, it does have a lot of really standard fantasy stuff, wizards and gods, but it also has like a completely different air to it because of the inclusion of the novel part, gunpowder and gunpowder magic, which I am very eager to share my various thoughts on.
Well, hold off for now, Geordie. We'll talk about that next time on the It's Just Fantasy podcast. If you have read Circe, Circe, Song of Achilles, gosh, Promise of Blood, any of the other books we have discussed or yet to discuss on this podcast, the best place...
Or Galatea. Her other, much shorter book of Greek mythology.
Yes, and very excited for her up-and-coming Persephone. It was announced in 2021 that will be the next book she's working on. As someone Ooh. Who has read the entirety of Lore Olympus, I am so excited.
Now that is interesting. I'm looking forward to that. I did not know that it existed. I guess we might not be getting Madeira at all. She might stop at 3, but I hope not. I hope she does everyone. I can't wait for Belathanus or whatever his name is.
Alan Miller is definitely the person to do it. Can't wait to read another one of her works. But until then, I've been your host, Duncan Nicol.
And I've been your host, Geordie Bailey.
Bye.
So long.